This is the lecture for Lesson 15 of the BSF study, People of the Promise, Exile, and Return. Hopeless. What do you think of when you hear that word? Something as simple as a stain on a favorite piece of clothing that won't come out no matter how hard we try? Or as complex as a broken relationship that cannot be repaired despite our best efforts? Hopeless situations and desperate circumstances fill our lives. My family is facing a seemingly hopeless situation right now. Someone in my family has an irreversible illness. Progressively, she will get worse, and we long for a cure, a treatment that will restore her, bring back her health and independence. Circumstances like this bring much heartache and fear. Powerless to reverse it, we cry out to God for help. But what we really yearn for, deep down what we really want, is a world free of these problems, a world free of sin and death. We long for God to right every wrong. We long for Him to make all things new. No more tears, no more brokenness, no more sickness, no more death. We long for God to reverse these terrible effects of sin, this curse of sin in our world. God alone has the power to reverse the curse of sin. He alone can bring new life in the face of death, new hope in the face of hopelessness. When our lesson ended last week, the people of God are facing their own hopeless situation. Haman has been executed at the king's order, but even with this great enemy Haman gone, all is not well for God's people. The edict to annihilate God's people still stands. Enemies loom large, waiting for the opportunity to attack. The day of destruction for God's people is just 9 months away. The people of God need a reversal of their death sentence, a new life and a new hope. And that is just what God offers to the Jewish people in Persia and to God's people today. We will look at these final chapters of Esther in two divisions and see that God sustains His people in chapter 8 and God secures His victory in chapters 9 and 10. We'll learn that God reverses the curse of sin to give His people new life. So let's begin with chapter 8, where God sustains His people. Now, chapter 8 opens on the same day that Haman was put to death. Haman's body has been impaled on the very pole that he erected for Mordecai. And then chapter 8 shifts back to the palace with King Xerxes and Queen Esther. As we examine this chapter together, we will see God's hand sustaining and providing for His people as God reverses the evil plans of men. God uses a new position in verses 1 and 2, a new plea in verses 3 to 8, a new edict in verses 9 to 14, and new hope in verses 15 to 17. So let's begin with God's use of a new position to sustain His people in verses 1 and 2. Open your Bibles with me and let's look at chapter 8, the first two verses. That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Haman was a man who burned with hatred for the Jewish people, especially Mordecai. Because of his hatred, Haman planned to plunder the Jewish people, enriching himself. Instead, Haman's entire estate is awarded to Esther, a Jewish woman and the relative of Haman's greatest enemy, Mordecai. Esther then reveals her relationship with Mordecai to the king. The man who reported the assassination plot against the king just happens to be Esther's adoptive father. The king then removes his signet ring, the one that previously sat on Haman's finger, and gives that ring and the authority it carries to Mordecai. Look at Mordecai's new position. He sits in Haman's seat and controls all of Haman's fortune. What a reversal! Now, Esther and Mordecai are not especially worthy of these blessings. They are imperfect people just like you and me. Yet God pours out His blessings on them. God provides in material ways in the form of new honored positions, financial blessings, and even political influence within the kingdom. But perhaps even more striking are God's spiritual blessings. Esther and Mordecai experience the blessing of being seen, heard, and loved by God. They get to witness God answering the prayers of His people. Esther and Mordecai are not perfect. We saw Esther herself hesitate the first time Mordecai asked her to approach the king on behalf of the Jews. She was fearful of losing her life by approaching the king without an invitation. Esther's people aren't perfect either. They are in this foreign land because of their unfaithfulness to God. The people have chosen to stay in Persia rather than return to Jerusalem with the first wave of returning exiles. Yet God loves and rescues them anyway. When God pours out blessings on undeserving people, we call that grace. Grace is the unmerited, unearned favor of God acting on his people's behalf. He does not owe us. We do not earn his loving kindness. God demonstrates his love and care for his people, delighting to bless them because of who God is, not what people do. Esther, Mordecai, and the people desperately needed the grace of God to sustain and save them, and we do also. We crave the same spiritual blessings of being seen and heard and loved by God. And God graciously pours these blessings out on his people today. God sees our suffering. God hears our cries. God surrounds us with his sustaining love. And just like Esther and Mordecai, we do not have to be perfect to receive God's grace. God's grace is for the undeserving. So in verses 1 and 2, God has set his people in new positions to sustain the Jewish nation. A Jewish woman sits on the throne of Persia as queen, and a Jewish man is second in command to the king. God's providential work and great grace is on full display. Now let's look at verses 3 through 6 as God sustains his people through a new plea from Queen Esther. Queen Esther and Mordecai just received great honor, power, and wealth from the king. Yet suddenly Esther falls to her feet weeping and begging King Xerxes to put an end to the evil plans of Haman. Haman might be dead, but his evil edict remains. Remember Haman's order that he executed with the king's signet ring? In order to exterminate all of God's people throughout Persia and the 127 provinces under the king's power, Haman cast lots to choose the day of the extermination of God's people. That date was the 13th day of the 12th month, Adar. Esther's people have about 9 months before the attacks begin. Imagine what that must be like, knowing the death sentence has been ordered, the date looming over God's people. How could God reverse this? God has positioned Esther as queen and Mordecai as second in command for just this moment, and now God moves in Esther's heart. The once hesitant Esther, now openly weeping at the king's feet, she is begging for the king to overrule the edict. Her pleas show the burden she carries for her people, many of whom are complete strangers to her. Listen to her words. How can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? Although Esther and Mordecai may be safe in the palace, Esther is troubled and burdened for those who aren't safe, for those condemned to death. Esther's people face the very real threat of death and need deliverance. In the same way, all around us today, people face the very real threat of death and judgment. Those who do not know Jesus as Savior face eternal condemnation. Do you and I feel that same burden and urgency for those who have not had their death sentence lifted by the sacrifice of Jesus? Whose eternal fate burdens my heart and your heart today? And here is the challenge. Are you and I just pleading for God to save them? Or are we also pleading with God to use us? Crying out, God, please use me. Put me in a place to share the truth. Where might God be uniquely positioning you and me to plead on behalf of his people and share the truth of Jesus? What about your workplace? He placed you there for a reason. Or our homes. He placed us with our children next door to our specific neighbors. Or perhaps he's calling you to a new place, even an uncomfortable place. Will you and I, as imperfect as we are, step forward in obedience, trusting that God himself will provide what we need to answer his call? So far we've seen God sustain his people through new positions and a new plea. And now in verses 7 to 14, we see God sustain his people through a new edict. The first edict to destroy the Jewish people cannot be revoked according to the Persian law. Their fate is hopeless without intervention from the king. The people need an act of the king, but they've done nothing to earn the king's favor. And King Xerxes is not even a follower of the one true God. Hopeless. But a king's heart in God's hand is moved. God is able to direct the hearts and minds of even pagan kings. No person is outside the sovereign control of God. And so pagan King Xerxes urges Esther to write a new decree on behalf of the Jews. Here we see God's grace on display again, the blessing of a new edict poured out on an undeserving people. We hear nothing of the people's extraordinary obedience or of some service to King Xerxes, yet the king acts on their behalf anyway, just like God acted on our behalf when we were still sinners, to provide for a way for our rescue, our salvation through Jesus. And so, by grace, God moves the king of Persia to urge his wife, Queen Esther, to write a new edict, but not just any edict. An edict on behalf of God's people, giving the Jews the right to defend themselves and even to plunder the Persian people who attacked them. The date of this counterattack falls on the very same day as Haman's edict, the 13th day of the 12th month. At once, Mordecai summons the royal secretaries who draft the edict and the script and language of every people group within the nation of Persia and all of its provinces, including the script and language of the Jewish people. The edict is sealed with the king's signet ring and delivered by the king's fastest couriers, and this new edict would signal to all who received it that the king of Persia stands with the Jews. In the third month, the edict is posted in the capital city of Susa. This gives God's people time to prepare and gives the Persian people nearly 9 months to have a change of heart, to abandon their plans to attack God's people. This new edict brings hopeful rejoicing and celebration. And so let's look next at how God sustains his people with new hope in verses 15 to 17. In verse 15, Mordecai leaves the king's presence with a new appearance and a new hope. Mordecai leaves the palace that day an honored man, clothed in royal garments, a large gold crown, and fine linen. Remember how grief-stricken Mordecai once was, standing outside the palace gates in sackcloth, mourning for his people? What a contrast. Now Mordecai is filled with the hope of deliverance. The city of Susa erupts in joyous celebration as the people receive the new edict. What a contrast to their reaction in chapter 3 when Haman's first murderous edict was delivered. The first edict brought confusion, but this new edict brings great joy and celebration. Just look at the words used in verses 16 and 17. Celebration, joy, happiness, gladness, honor, feasting, celebrating. Isn't it amazing how the people's outlook has changed just with the promise of deliverance? Enemies still seek them. Hardship still surrounds them. But even before the victory comes, the people have hope. God's grace sustains these exiled and hurting people. In chapter 8, we've seen God sustain his people by positioning new leaders that follow him, by responding to the new plea from the burdened heart of a faithful queen, by replacing evil plots with new edicts, and by providing new hope to his fearful people. In the same way, God's grace sustains you and me as we await his ultimate deliverance from pain, sickness, and suffering, from the power and presence of sin in the world. God's grace sustains us as we await his ultimate and final rescue. This brings us to the first principle. God sustains his people as they await his rescue. God sustains his people as they await his rescue. Just like the people of Persia needed God's sustaining grace, you and I do too. Our future with God in eternity is glorious, but the days here on earth can be hard. We suffer injustice, pain, and sickness, but it is God's grace that holds us up. his daily provision, his hand working in small ways and big ways to carry us through each day, the joy of his presence, the security of his sovereign control. I love the way our lesson notes explain it this week. It says, every morning, God's children awaken to a fresh supply of God's sustaining grace. What has God supplied for you and me today that is sustaining us? Will we choose to look for his sustaining grace even before the victory comes? God provides, in the words of that great hymn, strength for today and bright hope for tomorrow. Great is his faithfulness. Great is his faithfulness to sustain his people until the day of our great and final rescue. Let's look now at chapters 9 and 10, where we see God secures his victory. Now, months pass between chapter 8 and chapters 9 and 10. The dreaded day arrives. The date that the lot fell upon is here. But instead of a great defeat, God secures victory for his people. In chapter 9 and 10, we will see God secure his victory through a great rescue, a great rejoicing, and a great reversal. So let's look first at God's great rescue in chapter 9, verses 1 to 19. In verse 1, we discover that the enemies of the Jews still plan to attack. Did you expect something different? I did. Perhaps the enemies of the Jews in Persia would be deterred by what happened to Haman, seeing him impaled on a pole. Maybe hearing about Mordecai's promotion to second in command would give them pause. But instead, what we see is an enemy intent on destroying God's people. We find out that 75,000 Persians outside of Susa still have hearts to destroy, kill, and annihilate the Jewish people. For 9 long months, that evil hatred burns. Nothing deters them, and they attack. Within the capital city of Susa alone, 500 men plus the 10 sons of Haman attack the Jews on the appointed day. And the following day, an additional 300 men in Susa attack again. There are many in the Persian Empire, however, who do become Jews because the fear of the Jews rises within them. What does that mean? Well, fear here can mean a new respect for God's people, a conviction in their hearts of how wrong they've been, or even a recognition that the God of the Jews is powerful and real. Changed hearts, convicting hearts, that's a place we see God's grace working. Only God can turn the hearts of his enemies. Only God can place the fear of God within his enemies. And so on that fateful day, God intervenes behind the scenes to secure his people through a great rescue. The new edict, remember, gives God's people the right to defend themselves and even the right to take plunder from their enemies. These once fearful Jewish people trust in God and they step forward to strike down the enemy. The Persian nobles, governors, and administrators even fight alongside God's people. And not willing to settle for anything but complete victory, Queen Esther asked for a second day to eradicate every single attacker. And again, God's people are secure and victorious. Now think about that for a moment. This is not some sophisticated, trained army of Israelites. The Jewish people were captives, taken against their will to Persia, a small group compared to the native Persians. Yet somehow, this group of exiles musters the courage and overcomes the might of the Persians. An entire people group set to be killed is instead victorious. Only God can empower his people to stand up and fight against such odds and defeat such a great evil. I thought it was interesting that each son of Haman was listed by name in these verses. Why list their names specifically? If you remember back from chapter 5 of Esther, Haman boasted about several things: his vast wealth, his many sons, and the honor given to him by the king. Those were the treasures that Haman sought. Now, systematically, those treasures have been destroyed. His fortune transferred to Esther, his high position and honor given to Mordecai, and now his sons, with the same murderous intent as their father, are destroyed. Haman has no legacy remaining. The Jewish people seek different treasures. They do not take the plunder. When the people first conquered the land promised to them by God, God had instructed them not to take any plunder from their enemies, trusting Him alone for their provision. And so now, in this battle, the people choose to uphold God's law over King Xerxes' generous offer. They refuse the plunder and continue to trust in God's provision for the future. Unlike Haman, God Himself is their legacy and treasure. Is the same true of me and you? What legacy and treasure are you and I seeking? Secured by this great rescue of God, God now secures His victory through a time of great remembrance in verses 20 to 32. As God's people rest and celebrate their victory over the enemy, Mordecai issues another letter. Now, like the edict, this letter goes out to all people in all of the provinces, establishing a day of remembrance to be celebrated annually, the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. What was supposed to be a terrible day was reversed into a day of rejoicing. This feast day was called Purim, named after the pur, the lot or dice Haman cast to set the execution date. But lots do not determine the fate of God's people. God does. What men intended to be a day of dread is instead a day to remember the deliverance of God. Our Jewish brothers and sisters celebrate Purim still today. They read the account of Esther from God's word and they celebrate God's great rescue. They remember how God secured the fate of His people. They even eat these special cookies called Haman's ear as a sign of Haman's destruction. I was in a bakery recently that had Haman's ear cookies, and I was so excited to see one and to try one. Now, I know the story behind that cookie, and I got to share that story of God's deliverance with my children. That is what God calls us to do. Remember His stories of deliverance and share them. God has given you and me a story as well. How has God provided for you and sustained you in hard places? What story of God's amazing grace do you and I have? What is stopping us from celebrating our gracious God by remembering and sharing what He's done in our lives? Will we, like Mordecai, spread the good news of God's grace near and far? And finally, the book of Esther ends with God securing His victory through a great reversal in chapter 10, verses 1 to 3. Look with me at the final verse of Esther. Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all Jews. Mordecai, who once mourned in sackcloth outside the palace walls, is now dressed as royalty, and his name is recorded for generations to remember. Mordecai's reputation is reversed. He goes from reviled to recognized in the history books. How does that happen? Was it his might, his intellect? No, it was God's work through a faithful servant. God moves and positions Mordecai, and Mordecai faithfully steps up. Mordecai risks his own life because he believes that God will preserve his people just as he promised. Mordecai perseveres. He speaks up when others do not. Mordecai shows us what it looks like to believe that God will graciously provide all that we need to obey Him. Little and big steps of faith in the hands of our mighty God have profound impact. What little or big opportunity has God placed before you and me today to stand for Him and serve Him? Where has God positioned us to make an impact in His kingdom? How might God work through us as His faithful servants? But it was not just Mordecai's position, but the position of God's people is also reversed. Remember the state of the Jewish people at the beginning of the book of Esther? Confusion, despair, mourning, sackcloth, weeping, fasting, and fear. And now there is joy, gladness, honor, and victory. Only God can bring about a change like this. Have you wondered why? What did they do to earn this? Remember, they're in exile because of their unbelief and worship of other gods. Have we heard anything in the entire book of Esther that suggests God's people have changed so dramatically? No. It is God's grace alone, His unmerited favor poured out on unfaithful people. Why? Because He loves His people. Because God keeps His promises even when we do not. Because God longs to see His people restored. And so God will send them into exile to capture their hearts, and God will rescue them from certain death to capture their hearts. Do you want to know what happens to God's people next? They aren't fully delivered yet from their place of exile. They're going to face more enemies. They're going to stray from God again and again. God orchestrates a great reversal for them in Persia, but they need an even greater reversal. And so do we. A deliverance from our own sinful nature, a deliverance from the presence and power of sin in our lives, a deliverance from the death penalty due to all sinners. But we are hopeless. We are all hopeless without an act of the King. And God, by His grace, acts. We don't deserve it. We don't earn it. God provides a way to reverse the deadly curse of sin. God provides His Son, Jesus, who willingly gave up His life on the cross to pay the penalty for my sin and your sin. Through Jesus' death, those who turn to Him can have life instead of death. Christ's sacrifice reversed sin's curse for everyone who turns to Him for salvation. Just like the death sentence of God's covenant people in Persia was lifted, the death sentence is lifted for those who believe, not by our power, but by the edict of the King of all kings. Jesus cries out, "It is finished. The debt is paid. Victory is secured by God alone." So that leads us to our final principle. God alone secures victory for His people over sin. God alone secures victory for His people over sin. In their hopeless situation, Esther, Mordecai, and the Jewish nation yearned for victory that only God could secure. God rescued them, reversing their fate and giving them cause to rejoice. We all face seemingly hopeless situations in which we too long for a reversal. We want a victory to celebrate. This account in the book of Esther demonstrates that God's grace can sustain us in the waiting and secure ultimate victory. There is a day coming when pain, fear, and mourning will be turned to joy, celebration, and deliverance. When Jesus returns to conquer all of God's enemies and sin's presence forever, to finally and forever reverse the curse of sin. Maybe it will be in our lifetime on this earth. Maybe it will be once we leave this world to dwell in His presence for eternity. But either way, God will bring victory. God will bring victory over sin and every effect of sin we see in this world. And in the meantime, that's the hardest time. But in the meantime, we can trust His promise today. We can celebrate now, even as we wait to see it happen. What would it look like for you and for me to trust our hard circumstances to the God who orchestrated the greatest reversal through His Son, Jesus Christ? God can be trusted with whatever hopeless situation you and I are facing. Today, let's lean into Him and His promise to sustain us in the waiting, to trust Him with what lies ahead. May we find hope in the promise that God will forever reverse the curse of sin and bring us new life.
This lecture was written and produced by Bible Study Fellowship. For more information on BSF resources and Bible study groups, please visit bsfinternational.org.